Coming up next is an excerpt from the movie Jesus of Nazareth.
Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for what is right, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted in the cause of right, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people abuse you and persecute you and speak all kinds of calumny against you for my sake. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward will be great in heaven, as it was for the prophets persecuted before you.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. And if you're just joining this program, we're listening to Guantanamo Bay prisoners and the objections to Guantanamo Bay.
And I've come to realize more and more as time has gone on, the story only gets worse the more research I do into it, really, that they knew nothing about these people and had to build up a story. And they did this, whether through torture or other forms of coercion, or whether through bribing prisoners, pushing people until they just said, look, I can't take this anymore. What do you want to hear? I'll tell you a story. What purports to be the evidence against the prisoners is mostly statements that were made by their fellow prisoners, either in Guantanamo or in some cases in the black sites. Most of it is are allegations that were made by quite a small number of prisoners, and that when you subject it to any kind of analysis whatsoever, any kind of objective analysis whatsoever, it falls apart. People are claiming that people were in places that they couldn't have been. The whole thing is a house of cards built on these false statements, extracted coercively in most cases, in some cases by bribing prisoners with better living conditions, but the whole thing is hollow and disgusting. And, you know, that's why I got involved, that's why I'm still here trying to push these issues, because everywhere you look at this story, the kind of injustice that has taken place is horrible. And it's not an indictment of the American people that this happened, but it's an indictment of the American people that the crimes that are still going on continue to happen. Because this is, you know, this is the conscience of a nation should be at play here. It's a small number of people. It should matter how people are treated individually, but it's not just these individuals at Guantanamo. It's the principles that are at stake here. And we've been in a very, very troubling place for 11 years. And if this really does become the new normal, and, you know, and God forbid that in 4 years President Obama leaves office and still nothing has happened and the place remains open forever, that is such a profound stain on America's character that you know, I hope you realize the implications of that.
Tom.
Well, and it, this is not to say I want to compliment Andy, but I want to pay a compliment to Mo at the start of it, because he really represents the very best of the military tradition in this country. And I want to say, since I've been involved in the Guantanamo fight since the beginning, a lot of the people who stood up for the American principles were the military guys, and they were overridden by the civilians. But Mo, what you said, standing for the principles of the United States, the best tradition of the military, and I really have the utmost respect for you. from my own personal story, look, I'm a little Jewish kid whose grandfather came from Russia in 1880-something, and I, you know, one doesn't know whether the stories of your family are true, but we believe them. The story, my great-grandfather was a famous rabbi, and in the 1870s, he read the Declaration of Independence and the Gettysburg Address, and he said, if there really is such a country, I want my children growing up there. And my grandfather and his three brothers came to the United States. My grandfather, more than any religion, my grandfather would recite the Declaration of Independence, the preamble, and the Gettysburg Address to his kids. And we came to believe those things as the most important thing. And we believed in the principles of the United States and justice and the rule of law. And, you know, I believe really what Ronald Reagan said, that much more than our wealth or our power, our values are our greatest strength in the world. And I do believe what Mo said, that and Andy said, that principles are not something you have on paper. They really become, they matter when they're tested, and you've got to do it. And I also believe, and I might screw it up, but Dante's saying that the worst places in hell are reserved for those who stand silent in the face of injustice. So that's what.
Thank you. Open it up to questions. If you could identify yourself and ask a question and wait for the microphone so that the lady here with the blue dress.
Hi, Alice Olsen with Free Speech Radio News. You spoke a little bit about the roadblocks from Congress. Can anyone on the panel talk more about the specific ones that were just renewed or passed and what impact that will have?
Yeah, as we were talking before we came in, I had mentioned this is becoming a New Year's Eve tradition. You know, Congress passes the National Defense Authorization Act, and for the last couple of years, they've included language that prohibits, you know, using any of the funds that are appropriated in that massive bill to bring anyone from Guantanamo to the U.S., and also if anyone's being transferred out of Guantanamo, they've got to give do a certification to Congress and notice of why the reasons for the transfer out. This is 2 years in a row that the president said he would veto the bill if it passed. And on New Year's Eve, it becomes which is going to drop first, the ball in Times Square or Obama's veto threat? Because 2 years in a row, the president backed down. Now, some people say he's a pragmatist, but there's another P word I would use to describe what he has done by not standing up and keeping his word and restoring our reputation. Now, he says all the right things about the rule of law and values and principles, but he's failed to live up to his words. And so Congress has made it difficult. But if you recall, that's the same critics now are the ones that said that President Bush, that anyone that tried to interfere with his exercise of unilateral executive discretion, you know, it was unconstitutional to infringe on that power, are the same people that are trying to handcuff President Obama in exercising those same powers and making it difficult. But I think it takes the president as the commander-in-chief using the bully pulpit, as he's done recently on the fiscal cliff and with gun control and some other issues where he's stood up and taken the fight to the other side. He hadn't done that on these national security issues where he's let the other side carry the narrative.
Just as a point of information, if I am correct, he issued a signing statement, meaning that he had reserves the right to ignore that particular provision of the act?
Correct. But if you recall, he was always very critical of President Bush when President Bush used signing statements.
Right.
Now he's using signing statements to do exactly what President Bush did. But at the end of the day, he signed the bill that says you can't bring a detainee from Guantanamo to the U.S. or transfer them to another country without notifying Congress in advance.
Yep. Let me just say, the problem on that is it's subtle, too. Most people in the country believe Guantanamo is full of terrorists. So the word has not gotten out who they are, the people have been clear. In that context, there are a number of members of Congress who play to that fear and hysteria by saying, we're going to stand up and protect our constituents and we won't let them in the United States or somewhere else. So the way to oppose it, you know, you've got to oppose it by saying that they're wrong. There's got to be a thing. You can't just say, oh, I'm going to veto the bill. You've got to work earlier and take it on. In the context when you're fighting over the fiscal cliff and other things, the administration doesn't want to take it on. The Democratic Party doesn't want to take it on. The Republican Party doesn't even want to take on their crazy people. So the restrictions are in there. It needs to be a long-term plan of how you stop them from being in there, how you work this out. So.
Well, you know, a question for any of you. The 86 people who've been cleared for release, perhaps a little more detail about who advocated for those releases. I mean, it was a task force run by Matthew Olson, who's now the head of the National Counterterrorism Center, a long-term DOJ lawyer. Who else was involved in that process? How careful was the process?
The process after Obama was elected, it was really found, as Andy said, that you had these people in Guantanamo and people were saying they're bad or everything. They didn't even know who they were. They didn't have files on them. The files were scattered all over. So what the Obama administration said correctly is, let's review, let's collect the files together and put together a task force and review them to see who these people are, and we'll release, they said. Those we can. The task force was put together. Then it sort of got screwed up to start with because it took forever to put it up. And it included every agency. Matt Olson was really appointed as the director. Lisa Monaco was his, who is now assistant attorney general for, counterterrorism, or it was his deputy. And they had representatives from every agency, from the CIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, the Defense Department. It was a very conservative agency. And there had to be unanimous opinion to clear anyone for release. All the agencies had to agree that this person is not a current threat to the United States and not of intelligence value. So it was an extraordinarily careful, lugubrious, long process. Many of the people who weren't cleared, there's nothing on them, but they couldn't come to unanimous agreement. I mean, I hope that answers some. It was very conservative, careful. These people should be released.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Given the fact that Yemen, so many of these are Yemenis, and you know, the kind of counterpoint to what has been already discussed is that, of course, as you know, the Yemen prison system has been, you know, senior members of al-Qaeda have escaped not once but twice from Yemeni prisons. So is the fix simply a better Yemeni prison? I mean, what is the fix that would make these people who are Yemeni, who are cleared for release, how would this work?
Well, if I can say, Peter, you know, there are about 30 Yemeni prisoners that the United States government doesn't want to release.
Yeah.
When those decisions were made by the task force, it's slightly less than 30, I believe, that some of those were put forward for trial, recommended for trial. Some of those were recommended for indefinite detention without charge or trial because the government said they were too dangerous to release, but they didn't have sufficient evidence to put them on trial. That's a category that I have issues with. But, you know, I think it's important that we remain focused for now on the prisoners who were cleared. If this task force of these very sober officials approved these prisoners for transfer out of Guantanamo, surely that all that is required is the most minimal kind of supervision. Mm. Then it's not the suggestion that they should go from one prison to another. It's that they should be released. Now, you know, I think primarily because lawyers are involved, and I'm sure Tom can confirm this, it isn't just for reasons of security that they approve people for transfer rather than actually saying cleared for release. You know, let them go free. It's that lawyers are saying, don't ever admit any kind of responsibility for anything because, you know, then we'll get sued. These people are not dangerous. We're actually, when you ask that question, I'm having to calibrate their dangerousness. The task force would not have approved them to go if we were not talking about people who were insignificant.
Yeah. So what is the stumbling block on the Yemenis in particular?
Well, there are two stumbling blocks. The fear is that Yemen is unstable. So if, you know, it's more a political stumbling block. So if you release them, let me stand back. Mo is right. Other than the 15 to 30 people who may be dangerous, everyone agrees. These other people are nothing. I mean, even if they fought against us in Afghanistan 12 years, they're nothing. So they're really not dangerous people, these other people. And I mean, you talk to Olson and they say they're basically nothing people. So what is the stumbling block? The fear is that Yemen is unstable, that one of these people can get out, the Republicans in Congress are going to give them terrible hell and use it as political hay. That's more it. One of the reasons, some of these people could really be released in the United States if Congress weren't yelling around and saying, oh my God, they're dangerous. Don't let them near our children. You know, they've said that. People have said that even for people who everyone admits are innocent, like the Uyghurs. Everybody says these are innocent people. Congress will let Uyghurs into the United States. So the stumbling block is myriad. It's Yemen is unstable. We don't want people in the United States. If we don't let them in the United States, we go to other countries and say, well, if you don't take them in, why should we take them in? So, you know, it's a stepping stone system.
5 years ago, you know, when more people cared and there was more criticism because it was President Bush and criticism had kind of percolated through globally and even domestically that something was deeply wrong, And there was a lot of criticism. President Bush, you know, was releasing prisoners. There wasn't the questions that we have now of, you know, starting from a point of view of it seems to be very, very deeply unsafe to even release anyone, you know, and the most massive case has to be made for the release of anybody. So we've ended up with this extraordinary situation where cleared prisoners are held, which is, I keep repeating, is so deeply unacceptable. But, you know, it was almost easy for prisoners to be released 5 years ago. We're not fundamentally talking about different people, you know, because around half of the cleared prisoners were cleared for release under President Bush, but he didn't get round to releasing them at the time, because many of them were Yemenis, and because this Yemeni issue has persistently been there. If your nationality is Saudi, it became at a certain point quite easy to get out of Guantanamo, because the United States has a much closer relationship with Saudi Arabia, and negotiations were undertaken on that basis. So the Yemenis have always suffered. But, you know, it's really not acceptable, is it, that we can all agree, there are a few dozen Yemenis that everyone who has studied their cases has said, look, these appear to be quite dangerous people, so we're going to have to be very careful with these, and hopefully we can put most of them on trial. For the cleared prisoners to end up being the same, being treated the same, that's just wrong. So we need to be able to make the case that people who are pretty insignificant really are, that's it. Don't worry about it. Let's not crank up the hysteria and the fear, because that's what's been happening. Since President Obama made his announcement to close Guantanamo and then didn't follow up, and hasn't taken the lead, we've had people filling that vacuum whose mission is one of stirring up fear, and that mostly, I think, has been for their own personal political motives, not because they genuinely believe it.
No one's in charge.
You know, I think I mentioned this last year, so it's been that long, but I was driving and I heard on NPR, I turned on the radio and there was a story about this somebody being in prison in Cuba, and it was unfair, and I thought it was going to be a story, I thought it was going to be a story about Guantanamo, and it was about Alan Gross, who's an American citizen in prison in Cuba, and our government is really good about, if it's an Alan Gross, or Amir Hikmati was the American that the Iranians were going to put on trial in Iran, or the hikers that were picked up, or the people that were North Korea. You know, we're really good about, you know, how dare you hold an American citizen and insisting that, you know, it's, you know, a violation of the rule of law and you can't do this. Yet we've got people that have spent more than a decade in prison because of their citizenship. You know, that we have said did not commit a crime. They're not here to be punished. They're here because of their citizenship. And I would imagine the public, you know, the right-wing, you know, airbags that are on the radio and television would be pitching a fit if Americans were being held because of their citizenship year after year after year in another country. But, you know, we're supposed to be, you know, American exceptionalism, but which apparently creates an exception when we do things that we condemn others for doing, which is just fundamentally wrong.
This gentleman here. Can you wait for the microphone just a second?
I'm Eric Lewis. I litigated the case on behalf of the British detainees, civil torture and religious abuse case. I'd like to ask you about next year, with the withdrawal of all troops and the end of combat operations in Afghanistan, what is your view on the basis under the law of war for continuing to hold without detention or trial the people who are left at Guantanamo?
And just to add to that, so it is potentially an opportunity for Congress to revisit the authorization for the use of military force, which most Congress people, when they voted, probably didn't think was going to last for 12, 13 years. Is there any chance that there might be a modified authorization once combat troops leave Afghanistan?
I think there is. The question is, as Rick is pointing out, there's really no authorization to hold people. As Mo and Andy said, you really can arrest people for criminal charge, or in a combat situation, you could take troops up out and hold them till the end of the battle. And the purpose is not the punishment, but to keep them out of the battle. If the battle is over, I would say Congress would have no right to even authorize their holding. That's going to be an argument. And the argument for most of the people being held is that we are in a combat. Now, the government will argue they were really picked up in the continuing war on terror. I think, you know, this is technical. I don't think the Hamdi case, which authorizes detention, authorizes holding people in a continual war on terror. They say it's really, at least that case was decided on picking, it was an American citizen, but picking somebody up in the context of the particular combat that's going on. So, and this is confusing for people, but if the war is over, you can't hold people as, you know, purported prisoners of war.
It was encouraging. I think Jay Johnson, who is the general counsel for the Department of Defense, who unfortunately is leaving to go back back into to private practice, who, in my opinion, is a person I've got a lot of respect for. He gave a talk, I think, at Oxford, somewhere in England recently, where he didn't go into great detail on this, but suggested the same thing, that, you know, that this war is winding down, and when it does, the legal justification that we've used to detain these people likely goes away when the war winds down.
Wouldn't it also take away the legal justification for drone strikes outside a war zone in terms of out of a convention? I mean,
well, that's another issue.
Yeah.
Well, what is the answer?
You know, I'll let somebody else answer it, because I tried, as we did last year, to try to keep the drones away from this issue. I mean, you know, I'm terribly troubled by it. I think there are good arguments you can't do it. But one isn't contingent on the other. I want to get Guantanamo closed.
We have two lawyers here. The authorization for the use of military force, is that the underlying legal rationale for the use of drone strikes in places like Yemen?
No.
I think you have to keep in mind there are two drone programs. I think for the military program and the kill list that goes with that program, that yes, it's based on, you know, we're at war, and combatants can kill the enemy, even if they're unlawful, you know, deemed unlawful enemy combatants. I think it's much harder to make that argument on the CIA. I mean, like you said, it's the authorization for the use of military force.
Can I rephrase it? Mm-hmm. I'm not asking if it's completely legally kosher in your own minds. I'm asking, is that the legal basis under which the administration, both whether it's Bush or Obama, authorizes the use of CIA drone strikes?
We don't know for sure because they won't tell us. But at least from what they have said, because, you know, in the ACLU lawsuit trying to get the legal justification, you know, the government's argument is that the government has never officially acknowledged that we have a drone program.
Even the president's given interviews now, so it's...
But they're saying they've never officially, even though they talk about it and they, you know, crow about the success of the, you know, they said the government has never officially acknowledged that we have a drone program. But the argument in, like, Somalia and Yemen and Pakistan has been that we have the consent of the government to hunt down bad guys and kill them because it benefits us and them as well. So I don't know that the law of war is the legal rationale for those strikes.
There's a distinction. I think the government can make a strong argument based on the commander-in-chief's power under the Constitution that he has right to take action to protect the United States. It's a slippery slope, and you see how far it goes. And that's independent of the authorization for the use of military force. The authorization of a passage by Congress of something authorizing them makes his power stronger. As Justice Jackson said, when you have Congress and the president together, it's hard to do it. But I think they can argue under the Constitution. One of the differences is the right to detain people is always something that's been covered. I mean, it's aside from going and killing them. The right to detain people has always been something more in the judicial branch and covered by judicial review and the law. So you may have more right to use force than you do to detain people, the government.
But I think with the AUMF or the constitutional authority, those are great shields, you know, for a domestic criminal prosecution. But the Constitution or the AUMF can create international law. And when we're acting, killing people in Yemen or Pakistan or Somalia or other foreign countries, the Constitution and whatever acts of Congress, you know, have been passed are irrelevant.
I would just say that, if the United States really does pull out of Afghanistan, and that brings to an end the principle that you can have these wartime detentions, the problem that we run up against, which has been avoided for 11 years, is that people detained in wartime haven't been detained as people detained in wartime should be detained. Mm. We have sidestepped completely the Geneva Conventions and the fact that people are supposed to be held until the end of hostilities. Now, in a Geneva Convention sense, the withdrawal of U.S. troops would definitely signify that.
Combat troops, yeah.
Yeah, but the problem is that, when the Supreme Court decisions were made, the judges actually kind of echoed the Geneva Conventions by saying the AUMF also applies until the end of hostilities, setting up a kind of parallel Geneva Conventions detention provision that's based on the AUMF. The AUMF, I don't think, will be given up lightly by people with power and responsibility for it. That's the problem. That's part of the reasons we've seen an NDAA, the NDAA provisions to try and expand what the AUMF covers so that it doesn't narrowly cover just Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, but it can be expanded to whoever the hell the president decides is the enemy. know, it's very troubling. We will be put in a position where we can argue that we've reached the end, but I think the last 11 years have shown that there's a lot of institutional push for this war to be endless.
This gentleman over here.
Christoph Kribling, German Embassy. I have a question, maybe it's hypothetical or theoretical, but what would happen if President Obama would decide tomorrow, I close down Guantanamo, he as Commander-in-Chief, if he would do this, what would happen then? Could anyone or could Congress really block it, or what would happen if he would make this decision tomorrow?
Well, there are practical problems now with where the people can go. So it takes work to get it so you can empty the people out of Guantanamo. You really need to open it up so people can come to the United States, certain of them, certainly, and make it easier for them to go to third countries. It's a little bit like, and I go back to the Lincoln thing. Lincoln couldn't just say, I'm not going to allow slaves anymore. He needs to work it through a democratic political process here that is difficult, but you've got to work it. I mean, you couldn't do it tomorrow. There are a certain number of people who can't go back to Syria, who can't go back to China, others who really can't go anywhere. They may need to be in the United States for a while. By the way, if they're in the United States for a while, I think we could effectively challenge detentions of those people who are being illegally detained. There are people, there are Kuwaitis there who could go home. So you need to work it, but you need to be committed to working and get them out of there. Fact is, he hasn't done that.
Yeah, I would say that the problem is that we have to define who those groups of people are. We've done some of that today. The Yemenis, the other people that Tom talked about. I mean, while Tom was talking, I just realized that there is one stateless Palestinian still at Guantanamo. You can't return Palestinians from Guantanamo because you have to go through Israel, and those negotiations never went anywhere. So all the other Palestinians in Guantanamo, there were a handful of them, have been resettled in other countries. This young man was, actually, he was almost taken in by the German government in August 2009. The Germans were going to take three and only took two in the end, and he's one. He can't go anywhere until somebody offers him a new home. So he's just one example. So, you know, there are the Yemenis, there are the other cleared prisoners, and then there are the rest of the prisoners, the ones who are either designated for trials or indefinite detention. There's only those three groups for us to talk about, but that's what we have to push when we're talking about how to close the prison.
You have to let it all go, Neo. Fear, doubt, and disbelief. Free your mind.
And now for something completely different.